The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I wanted to talk tonight about tranquility. And, well, first of all, what is tranquility? It's calm or peacefulness, serenity, the absence of agitation, essentially. So when we're in a state that's tranquil, we are not disturbed or knocked off kilter by the things that we encounter in a human life, like pleasure and pain, adversity from others, surprises, ups and downs, gains and losses. So in many ways, this is something that, you know, we think of as some kind of an ideal in meditation. And there are many ways to explore it. Calvin Coolidge said, 70% of the world's problems are caused by the fact that people cannot sit down and be still. And I don't know where he got 70% exactly, but it's certainly true that a lot of excess activity is going on out there in the world. And we know from our own experience that being agitated is not only uncomfortable in that moment, but also when we speak or act from our agitation, that tends to cause even more problems. I think we've all experienced that in some way. So it's worth examining tranquility a bit more carefully, because the Buddha does point towards it in the teachings. Tranquility was a big focus of my practice early on for the simple reason that I really needed it. I came to the practice with quite a lot of anxiety and agitation. And so what I needed to do first was sit down and be still. And I remember when I had a moment where I felt like I had connected with something inside that was actually still, and this was a big surprise to me. And so I told Gil about it, and he said, oh, that's very interesting. Maybe you should try to connect with that and act from that place a little bit more often. And developing that, you know, I tried to take that advice, and developing it has been very fruitful over the years. So we get many opportunities just in all the regular aspects of life to practice tranquility, and it is a practice. It doesn't just happen, and we don't do it perfectly. For example, my internet connection was down this week, completely down for several days, multiple calls to the internet service provider. Finally, they sent a technician out. Every time I called, it was a different person in India, and I needed to go through the same set of things. You know, did you really try unplugging that and plugging it back in? Yes, I really did try that several times. So this certainly required a certain amount of tranquility and calmness to not do unwise speech. Also, I sensed a certain amount of agitation just knowing that my internet connection wasn't there. It's really interesting to have that feeling like, oh, I can't just go look up that address, or I can't just send a message. So there's a little bit of attachment there, and that was causing a little bit of underlying agitation that I was aware of while it wasn't there. In addition, I recently went on a car trip, a long driving trip up through the Pacific Northwest, and I was staying with different people each night. And so I was staying in a different bed, and, you know, I knew these people, they were friends of mine, but still I was fitting into their household. They eat different food, they get up at different times. One place I was sleeping in the attic on one of these mattresses that, I don't know, it's designed to like be a shape memory sort of thing. I don't know, it was quite different. So there was, you know, definitely a sense of just having to flow along with what was going and stay tranquil through all of that. So just in our everyday life, we could count how many times we have an opportunity to be tranquil every day. So that's why the Buddha talked about it. It's something that comes up frequently. So we can ask, where does tranquility appear in the teachings? And the Pali word for tranquility is pasadi. Pasadi. And it appears not as frequently as some of the more popular things like energy or mindfulness or concentration, but it does appear in a couple of key places. In fact, it appears in one of the most important lists, which are the seven factors of awakening. And tranquility is the fifth of these. And these are factors that become very strong in the mind when it is very close to insight. And they support the mind in being able to let go. So this is an important factor just for that reason. Tranquility also appears in a wonderful teaching called Transcendent Dependent Origination, which is a mouthful, but essentially what that is it describes a process through which we encounter suffering, which we do every day, all the time, and it's the way that the mind can respond to that suffering such that it turns toward liberation and frees itself instead of looping back into more suffering. So it's a way to pull up out of that pattern. And tranquility appears there also as a key step in that process. So what's common about these two different places that tranquility appears, or at least two places, in the factors of awakening and in transcendent dependent origination, is that in both cases it comes right after joy. So it's interesting to notice that wholesome joy, joy on the path, is something that leads toward calm. So it's not that joy is something where we get more and more excited, or it just, you know, leads to straight up to rapture that doesn't end. It actually leads, you know, meditative joy leads toward a calming, toward a turning inward. It's the step before we start coming in, a settling. Also, in both of these cases, tranquility appears just before concentration. So in that sense, we can see that it's a preparation for entering a more deeply concentrated state, which kind of makes sense. An agitated mind is not about to enter a concentrated state, whereas a calm mind could be. So we could say that the function of tranquility on the path is to prepare the mind for concentration. So it's important not to gloss over this step. It's very easy to get interested in meditation and decide, oh, I'm going to get concentrated. So you sit down and you try to get concentrated. But if the mind isn't calm, that's not going to happen. There's no way to leap right into concentration without calming first. So it's a process. The Buddha is clear that we don't start with a calm, tranquil mind. So don't worry if you are noticing that yours isn't. The untranquil mind is actually the sort of normal state for an untrained mind. And a mind that's not tranquil can't achieve discernment or liberation. So that's why we need to train. There are a number of places in the teachings where the untranquil mind is actually talked about. It's compared, lovely analogies, it's compared to a flopping fish and to something that's not straight. So our task is to basically calm and align the mind so that it becomes a useful tool. Bhikkhu Bodhi uses lovely long words a lot, and I think his language is just beautiful. So if you like his phraseology, he says, tranquility induces the qualitative factors of lightness, malleability, wieldiness, proficiency, and rectitude. So this is a calm mind. It becomes a useful tool, something that can be directed in the way that we want it to. Actually, the Dhammapada has a number of very nice verses about this untranquil mind. I'll just read a few of them. Quivering, wavering, hard to guard, to hold in check, the mind. The sage makes it straight, like a fletcher, the shaft of an arrow. Like a fish, pulled from its home in the water and thrown on land, this mind flips and flaps about to escape Mara's sway. Hard to hold down, nimble, alighting wherever it likes, the mind. Its taming is good. The mind well tamed brings ease. Has anyone experienced a mind like this? And then there's also a verse that points towards the fact that an unsteady mind cannot know and see the Dharma. So it can't know and see things as they actually are. So hence a lack of tranquility prevents insight. It says, for a person of unsteady mind, not knowing true Dhamma, serenity set adrift, discernment doesn't grow full. So the good news is that tranquility has a cause. It's a conditioned state, so it can be developed. And we don't start with a tranquil mind, but it can be moved towards in a number of deliberate ways. There are many conditions, actually, that support the development of tranquility. So I'll just talk about a few that I have found through practice. And I would encourage you to look in your own life also and really consider, what does make my mind more tranquil? And how could I do more of that? Or conversely, take a look at what makes your mind agitated and figure out how to do a little bit less of that. That's the same effect. So first of all, I would point towards ethical behavior, following the precepts. This leads the mind to a state of what's called non-remorse. So we know that we haven't been killing, we haven't been stealing or lying, intoxicating ourselves or misbehaving sexually. Then we can feel calmer. We're just going to feel better about ourselves. It's really not a matter of, you know, no, no, don't do that. It's a simple matter of I feel calmer and more at ease when I align myself in this way. So that's actually one of the main functions of sila, of ethics on the path, is to calm the mind so that we can meditate. Another condition that supports tranquility is faith or confidence. Essentially, knowing that there is an alternative to our usual reactivity to suffering. So we can observe that ups and downs happen. Suffering certainly happens. That's the first noble truth. And if we're in a state where we are reacting to that all the time, it makes us angry, it makes us depressed, it makes us overexcited or fearful, anxious, then clearly that's not tranquil. And we may spend a lot of our lives living in that kind of reactive mode until until we encounter meditation or we encounter the Dharma or we encounter someone who points out that there's another way of responding. We don't need to just follow our whims and our mind in that way. We can observe, for example. We can be mindful. We can redirect our mind toward wholesome things. And so as we start to figure out that we can actually do that some of the time, this is called confidence. And we start thinking, okay, there is hope. There is hope. And thank goodness there's another way. We don't have to just keep reacting. We're not a slave to the conditions around us. We have internal resources that can help us, since we can't control necessarily all the things that happen from the outside. So this is a good condition for becoming more easeful, more tranquil. Another great one is gratitude. If we're feeling edgy, out of sync, uneasy. Think about what's going well. Think about the things that you're thankful for. Some little thing that happened today. I'm thankful that I saw a pretty flower walking in here. Or something larger, you know, that we have a roof over our head, that we have good friends. This greatly eases the mind just to remember that there are those things supporting us. Another important factor is actually to value tranquility, to pay attention to it. This is the principle of what we appreciate appreciates. So just being aware of tranquility and noticing when it happens and noticing when it doesn't happen helps it to grow. When we pay attention to wholesome things, they get stronger. And when we pay attention to unwholesome things, they get weaker. It's one of the beauties of mindfulness. Another condition is association with calm people and avoiding restless people. So it's who you know, as they say. But really, I think perhaps many of us have observed that if we're with somebody who's very agitated or has a tendency to be that way, we're more likely to get drawn into it. And that's natural, just because we're responsive. We're sensitive creatures. Absolutely, we respond to our environment. And in the same way, if we're around calm people, we come to IMC and we sit here for a little while, we feel calmer. It's not magic. So this is something that we can then do deliberately. Of course, we can't always avoid all the restless people. Some of them may be people that we live with. But certainly we can make choices where we can to associate with people that have the traits that we want to develop in ourselves. Another thing that I've found quite conducive for tranquility is being in nature. Just go out for a hike or somewhere with a lot of open space. You know, these external conditions can really support a calming, easeful, just remembering that the animals are there living their lives fairly normally. They don't get all upset about what somebody said to them this morning. The plants look pretty tranquil, blowing in the breeze. Oh, right. And so then the mind starts calming down and remembering that it too is part of nature and can just flow along with the way things are. Time. Not being in a hurry or needing to get things done is a great support for tranquility, for feeling calmer. Often there are things that we think we really need to get done, but it's less important than we think it is. I remember Gil said that when he feels like he has just too many things to do, a very long to-do list and not enough time, and he feels his mind kind of tensing a little bit, that he'll sit down and meditate. And he says, it's amazing. After 10, 15 minutes, I have a lot more time. So our relationship to time has a big effect on how calm our mind can be. And as you might guess, underneath all of this are things like self-concerns. So anything having to do with the self tends to produce some amount of agitation, some kind of an image that we're trying to uphold, some kind of a view that we're trying to put a stake in the ground and defend. This is going to agitate the mind. So for instance, I certainly had some self involved in this internet connection issue, because a little bit I'd looked at this agitation I had, and part of it was because I wanted to be smart and be able to, you know, have the whole vast knowledge of the internet connected to my brain and pretend that that was part of it, and I couldn't when I couldn't connect. And another part was that I wanted to see myself as someone who's responsive. You know, if somebody sends me an email and they know I'm usually online during the afternoon and I could have quickly responded, but instead it was 2 days later because I didn't have a connection or whatever, then I'm not living up to my self-image of how I want to be. So it's nice to let go of things like that, because that's that's all me. It's all, I'm causing myself that agitation, that suffering, and it's not necessary. On the other side, when I was reflecting about this, I was remembering that one time I gave a party, and it was one of these nightmare scenarios that people sometimes have where nearly nobody showed up. It was amazing. I think I invited like 20, 25 people, and about 4 ended up coming. So, but it was interesting that at the time, I was actually fine with that. I didn't really see it as reflecting on me personally. And I think my biggest regret was that I just couldn't eat all that food, and some of it kind of went to waste. I mean, I froze as much as I could and all that and gave away, but anyway. But it was nice to reflect on that later and think, you know, there was a time in my life, like during my teenage years, when that would have been totally devastating. But, you know, it was just a funny scheduling thing, and people who said they could come couldn't, and whatever happened, and that was how the numbers worked, and it wasn't about me. So it's worth noticing what we would sacrifice our tranquility for. That's kind of the flip side, and it's usually related to the self. You know, if you're in a tranquil state and you're enjoying it, great, please enjoy it, but it's going to end. It's, you know, it's temporary. So notice what it is that allows it to end. Why does it cease? What came up in your mind that you gave up that tranquility for? Sometimes I can get caught, for example, in whatever seems to be needed to fit into a situation. This is a normal sort of human thing. Like, say, maybe some years ago, if there was gossip going on, I would feel drawn in to participate in that because that was what was going on. And so I understood intuitively that to fit in, that was the thing to do. So I was choosing an unskillful verbal response in favor of, you know, instead of upholding what I know to be the precepts. And so then later I would think, ah, that wasn't so good. And I wouldn't have had that little thought if I'd been willing to not fit in that moment, you know, not have that self. Stronger tranquility, actually, you know, we might think, oh, well, then I'm not going to be able to fit in, or I'm not going to be able to respond. But stronger tranquility actually grounds the mind, and so it allows a more creative response. There probably becomes a way to fit into the situation and uphold, you know, our whatever we want to, you know, whatever ethics we want to fit into at that moment. So definitely true that paying attention to tranquility is going to help us in many of these social situations. So I've talked about many things that occur in daily life, and tranquility, I think, is really often a daily life practice. But really, it occurs in meditation also. And tranquility is very much a factor of the body. So I, you know, when I first connected with it, it was a feeling of stillness kind of in my chest. And there are ways to meditate that help bring about tranquility in the body and also, you know, reflected in the mind. So one way that I recommend is a practice of full body breathing. And what this is it's standard breath meditation. You sit down with the intention to notice the breath. But instead of choosing the one point where it feels the strongest, you know, we're often encouraged to choose the nose or the chest or the belly, wherever we feel it. I recommend feeling the breath as it penetrates the whole body. You know, can you feel the breath all the way into your legs, for example, or all the way through the front and the back of your back? Can you feel sort of a three-dimensional feeling to the body as the breath comes in and goes out? And as we deliberately spread the breath through the body, that's the next step, is to kind of find those tight places or those numb places where the breath isn't going, and try to put it there, try to encourage it to flow so that the whole body is completely full. You'll find a lot of spots of tension doing this, and have the intention to relax them, allow the breath to penetrate through them, in and out. And this is something that will strongly tranquilize the body. You can do it as a sweeping thing if you want, start at the top and go to the bottom. Or I actually am not even that systematic about it. I literally just look around for places of tension, and when I find them, do a little focus there, relax them as much as they can, and then the next bottleneck is the next thing that's too tight. Find that when it becomes looser than the next one that's too tight. And just go around the body that way. You can do a whole session this way. It feels wonderful, usually. Sometimes you'll find some spots you can't untense. So, actually, one time I told a teacher that I was meditating with the intention of completely relaxing my body. That was how I described it. Maybe it wasn't a very clear description. And the teacher laughed and said, well, don't end up as a puddle on the floor. but I can say that far from this, actually, the actual result of this kind of whole body meditation, for me at least, was to discover that the body has its own energy and that it's really self-supporting from the inside. And so as you relax more and more, eventually the insight comes, you know, I'm really doing almost nothing to hold myself up. I've relaxed almost everything. There is a spot where the body can stand, sit perfectly upright, and have almost no muscular contraction, and yet be completely stable and relaxed. So finding that position physically was the fruit of doing this kind of practice, and that, in fact, helps the body to concentrate quite a lot. So that's, I would say, that is the method through which tranquility is the foundation for concentration in the body, at least. So if you're interested in that type of body practice, I recommend it. It has good results. There are some challenges in developing tranquility. As will naturally happen when we try to develop something, there will encounter obstacles to that. So the obvious obstacle, of course, is agitation. That's what we're trying to counter with tranquility, in a sense. But there are other more subtle things that we'll encounter as we work on pasadi. And the first is doubts of various kinds. Pasadi is one of the less popular factors of enlightenment. People like joy a lot better, for example. And one reason is that people can... tranquility is a funny word, or maybe even the concept is funny. People sometimes see it as opposed to compassionate action. So there's a sense that tranquility opposes seeking justice, to having proper righteous anger about the state of the world and our ability to respond. You know, are we just going to sit there, you know, tranquil? Or on a more personal level, if you look a little, I encounter this in myself, for example, looking a little more deeply, I had some concern that tranquility, too much tranquility, would make me into somebody somewhat passive and unable essentially to, I don't want to use the word compete, but, you know, unable to function in the world, which often demands us to be agitated, competitive, etc. Not that we want to be that way, but the question is, if we relax out of that, are we going to, like, not do our job? Are we going to, you know, just become a couch potato? Is that what tranquility is? Are we going to be able to unable to secure our livelihood? How many job descriptions say that they're looking for a calm person compared to one that's looking for dynamic, passionate, someone with a lot of drive? I mean, you can actually see those words in job requisitions, right? And so you go into the interview thinking, okay, I've got to show them that I'm really with it and together and on the ball. And this is not, you know, if you go in there and say, one of my main strengths is that I'm really calm, you're going to get the job. So, I mean, maybe you would. There are jobs where you would, and that's definitely more truthful. But there can be a concern, right, that this is not going to, you know, not going to work out for us in the world. So these kinds of doubts, I think, are often based on a wrong impression of what tranquility is. So we have this image of passivity. The word tranquility, unfortunately, is used as like a tranquilizer. You know, we think of animals being shot with a dart gun to be tranquilized so they can go to the vet, or people lazing around addicted to Valium or morphine or something like that. So this is not necessarily what tranquility looks like. It's something that can look different for each of us, and it's something that can have energy in it. It's, you know, true tranquility in the sense of being a factor on the path is quite vibrant, actually. And we need to find a way for our calmness to have some life to it. And not, the Buddha didn't want people to be passive and just non-responsive. So I think Indira Gandhi said it very well when she said, "We must learn to be still in the midst of activity and to be vibrantly alive in repose." Isn't that beautiful? We must learn to be still in the midst of activity and to be vibrantly alive in repose. Does anybody use the word repose anymore? I think it's a fabulous word, repose. So that's one issue with developing tranquility, and it's worth examining any doubts that you have about it in order that you understand what they are and why they're there. Another thing that we may encounter with tranquility is dullness. Doing these very relaxing body meditations, we can get ourselves lulled down into a stupor. So we can actually fall into this passivity or this, it's called sinking mind. And that is not proper tranquility. The Buddha even pointed out that there are times to develop tranquility and times not to develop tranquility. And if we're feeling tired, or otherwise passive or lazy, that's not the time to develop tranquility. Then we develop energy and joy and investigation, those sorts of things that are more active. But if we're feeling agitated or overexcited, that's a great time to develop tranquility. So there's a little bit of discernment about when to develop this factor. And so if you find your mind falling into dullness, then, you know, find something more energizing to do with it. And then I think a third challenge in developing tranquility is attachment. Tranquility is very pleasant, and so it's possible for the mind to become attached to it. We can become attached to anything, even really good states. It can, mostly this is again based on an incorrect understanding. So we may believe that our tranquility is dependent on certain types of external conditions. We must have absolute silence and, you know, no distractions anywhere. And why is that car going by outside when I'm supposed to be tranquil? There's no way I can be tranquil in this urban meditation center. So, for example, this is a little story from Ajahn Sumedho. He says, "I was a very junior monk, and one night Ajahn Chah took me to a village festival. We were very serious practitioners and didn't want any kind of frivolity or foolishness. So going to a village festival was the last thing we wanted to do, because in those villages, they love loudspeakers." He's talking about Thailand. "We had to sit up all night with the raucous sound of the loudspeakers, and I kept thinking, oh, I want to get back to my cave. And then I began to see for myself, here I am getting all upset over this. Is it that bad? Loudspeakers and noise and distraction and sleepiness, I can put up with. But it's that awful thing in my mind that hates it, resents it, and wants to leave. That's the real misery." So he's having a very aversive reaction to an environment that's loud and raucous because he has in his mind the idea that he wants to be tranquil and that tranquility requires silence and peace and, you know, sitting in a cave. Whereas in reality, when he woke up and he said, "Oh my goodness, this is just my mind," at that moment he was at ease and he remembered and he could sit there through the loudspeakers in calmness, because he wasn't caught in this idea, in this aversion. So we can believe that tranquility requires a certain kind of setting or certain food or whatever. But as we develop tranquility more deeply, it becomes something that we carry inside of us. So just like I had noticed that still point inside of my chest, it's something that's right in the middle of our being anyway, and we can carry it with us. It can become something that is always available, that we can just tap into no matter what is going on around us. As it gets stronger, it becomes like an anchor, something that can hold us in the present moment, keep us grounded. And so at that point, we can begin to take our tranquility into challenging situations. And They're fruits of developing tranquility, and they're both external and internal. One of them is that tranquility becomes a gift for other people when we're carrying it ourselves. So, for example, if there's a lot of agitation going on, just having one calm person in the room can be a complete blessing, can save the whole situation. We've maybe encountered this where several people were freaking out or reacting, and the one person who was calm was able to just steer the whole group through it. So it can become something that we can share with others. It doesn't just exist inside of us. In fact, as part of my spiritual practice, I seek out challenging situations sometimes. For example, I did a human dissection course to see what it would be like to try that out and be in the same room with that and actually perform the dissection. And it was challenging, but it was a great time to connect with that that calmness right in the middle. I'm also a hospice volunteer, so I sit with people who are dying. And that's a time that there can be agitation, not only for that person, but for the family around them. And having somebody come who offers a presence, someone who is right there and is taking in and is really seeing the situation, but is not reacting to it, that becomes a gift. That's what people can remember about, you know, how they were able to deal with the situation, is that somebody could offer them that. So the calmness we develop is certainly pleasant, it's certainly helpful for our practice, and it's a great gift to the world. It can help other people to find their own calmness also, see their own truth. If you're sitting calmly with someone who's trying to work through something challenging, they can begin to see their own calmness and begin to see what's true for them because you're there not reacting also. And eventually we can begin to give this gift of tranquility back to ourselves also. We gain the ability to sit with discomfort. That means that we can turn the mind toward very challenging truths that we encounter in meditation. The complete insecurity, unsatisfactoriness and impersonality of the world. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the three characteristics that we study in this practice. It doesn't just happen in challenging situations like the hospice. Everything is dying. Everything is ending. Every instant, it's appearing and vanishing and washing away into nothingness. And we may encounter this in the mind, in meditation. And if we can sit still and watch that happening, then the mind can be free, can really understand and see that without grabbing onto it, turning away from it. The ego doesn't want to understand that it doesn't exist. And only through tranquility are we going to be able to sit with that truth. That's why tranquility is a factor of enlightenment. So please develop tranquility. Every small act of reducing the agitation in our lives points us toward the profound result that we can achieve this way. It all counts. May we all be free. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes for any comments or questions. Yes, Maureen.
As you were speaking, something occurred to me that as I take inventory of my reactions to things, I'll say, oh, I'm proliferating, or, you know, I just, you know, will notice things as they happen. I'm not taking inventory of the tranquility. It's when I leave the tranquility that I notice, and it's, oh, maybe my accounting system is a little skewed. Thank you.
Yeah, we're very attuned to notice the negative or notice suffering or the pain. That's the first noble truth, so that's okay. But there's also the third noble truth of realizing cessation, noticing when there isn't the suffering. So yeah, and a big part of developing it is turning our mind toward it. And it can be subtle. It can be very subtle, because when the mind isn't suffering, stuff's just going through it. But yes, wonderful to notice it when we can. Oh, could you wait for the mic?
It's not about tranquility. It's a question about long-term practice. I've had a daily practice for about 3 years, and I've come to IMC probably about a half a dozen times in that time. But otherwise, I practice alone. And I was wondering, short of entering a live-in program, which would be an enormous step that most people would take, what is the in-between step by which one develops an ongoing dialogue about your sitting practice with someone who actually knows more than you, as opposed to going to a sangha where everybody has been, not that that's true here, but where everybody has been sitting for the same amount of time or maybe has no other experience than their own to bring to it.
Mm. I don't know if anybody has any experience other than their own to bring to it in the end. Do you have enough time to go on a retreat?
I've been to Spirit Rock for a retreat for one day, and and I have been and I did Andrea Fellow's class here for 6 nights.
So you did the householder retreat?
No. It was the 6 week beginner's class.
Oh yes.
I have not done like a 2 day or a 3 day or anything that long before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as you look to deepen your practice, there are a number of ways to do that. One is to start sitting for longer times. Come to day long retreats, for example. It can be fruitful to speak with a teacher about your practice. Try having an interview, for example, which is available at some of our day-longs here. That can start to give you some guidance. And at the same time, there are a number of opportunities for speaking with other practitioners who are also encountering the same things or have maybe, walked a little farther along the path through some of our things called Dharma practice days, for example. These are times when people discuss their practice. I definitely wouldn't dismiss speaking with other practitioners. Gil makes a big point that at monasteries, much of the learning occurs between the students, not so much necessarily with the teacher. So it's very fruitful to have wise friends who are also practicing on the path. And the more of people like that you can encounter and surround yourself with, the stronger support you'll have for your practice. All right. We're all very tranquil tonight. So we'll go ahead and end, and I'll be up here if anyone has any other comments or questions. Thank you.